University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Saeed Arikat, Executive Director of the Palestine Congress of North America, with his lecture, Palestine, an Update. The PCNA's goals are to build a better image of Arab people and to strengthen the political lobby on behalf of a Middle East solution that will provide Palestinians with their own homeland. The group, which was formed in 1979, has a current membership of approximately 20,000 people, supports official Palestine Liberation Organization policy aiming to establish an independent Palestinian state. However, the group has no official links with the PLO.
With this, all this wiring, I could be run by remote control. And I bet you would love that. Just shut me off whenever you want to. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we're making progress as far as the Palestinian cause is concerned. There was a time when you walked into an auditorium like this, and we would have 90% vacancy. Now it's only 60% vacancy. Well, I don't really know how much you know about the struggle in the Middle East or how much exposure have you had. But believe it or not, the things that are going on there have really started long before the 9th of December 1978. Now, I know that there was a bit of concentration over the past 16 months, or a bit more concentration on the events in the region under the coverage of the so-called Intifada in the West Bank and Gaza. And some people think that, you know, that's when the whole issue really erupted. No, it's been going on for a long, long while. As a matter of fact, the uprising, the Intifada, that is going on strong for now almost 17 months, is the byproduct of those many, many years of military occupation, many, many years of oppression. And it's natural for a people, after so many years, to take matters into their own hands, because people have an inherent desire to be free, and they just won't give up that feeling, won't give up that desire, that notion, the notion to struggle until they are free. To give you an idea for those who do not, and I am sure being college students, many of you do know a little bit of some background, a history. But the problem in Palestine goes back almost to the turn of the century when, as a result of the so-called Jewish problem, especially in Europe, you know, the Jews have been the subject of persecution and discrimination in Europe through the ages, and people sought to solve. You know, they looked for a solution to the Jewish question, the Jewish problem. There were a number of suggestions. Now, with the rise of the industrial bourgeoisie in Europe, with the rise of nationalism as well in Europe, the issue seemed to be more and more pressing. So a group of people organized the first Zionist Congress, towards the end of the century, and they thought that the better solution for the Jews is to really gather them in one place. That's the only way to avoid Christian or Western discrimination, you know, to overcome the pogroms, to overcome the problems that they have had. And there were many suggestions as to where the state should be. You know, someone suggested Uganda, for instance. Others suggested it could be in Argentina. You know, others thought, well, no, we are part of Western civilization and thought to be somewhere in the in the in the West somehow. And others thought of the historical place for the Jews, which is Palestine. You know, and Palestine is appealing. You know, it can it has an emotional thing. You know, it can entice actually the Jews to come to such a place instead of going to Uganda, you know, or other places. And the effort went on. You know, Theodor Herzl, the organizer of the Zionist movement, said that in 50 years there will be a state, a Jewish state in Palestine, and he was almost, his prediction was almost to the letter, because 50 years later the state of Israel was established in 1948. Again, you know, the turmoil of the First War, the fact that Palestine was under the Ottomans, you know, the Turkish Empire, and the fact that the Turks were on the wrong side, so to speak, in the First World War with Germany. And they lost, you know, and when you lose, whatever you have becomes divided among the conquerors. So as a consequence, we also lost, because the people of the region who were occupied by the Ottomans, their lands became now occupied by the British and the French, you know, the new colonial powers. As a, you know, as for whatever political and strategic means, the foreign secretary of the British Empire at the time, in 1917, declared his famous declaration, a man by the name of Balfour, and that is the famous Balfour Declaration. And he said that His Majesty's government would be very much interested in creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Of course, there were, you know, a lot of other things involved in his declaration, such as that the non-infringement upon non-Jewish communities in Palestine, knowing full well that the Jewish community in Palestine was a very, very small community. And that really sort of thrust, you know, the effort, put it into a whole, you know, in a first gear, so to speak, you know, and it provoked, you know, a wave of immigration, a Jewish immigration into Palestine. And the Arabs in Palestine were actually resistant to that immigration. And there were a number of uprisings, very much like the one that is going on today, sometimes even more violent and more bloody. In 1921 and 1924 and 1929, every wave of immigration provoked resentment among the population. People organized armed revolutions. They were fighting against the British forces. They were fighting against Zionist forces in Palestine. The Zionists were fighting against the British. It was just a mess, chaos, you know. But definitely people are willing, anywhere in the world, I think, you know, willing to defend themselves, to defend their right to their historical homeland, to defend the right to till that land, to continue to live as they have over the centuries. Now, with the Second World War, a new dimension, a new development. You know, you had this a new kind of war. You know, a horrible war with the consequences horrifying. The Nazi experience and the Nazi legacy is one that is well known to all of us. And the Jews, as one of the primary victims of this horrible war, sort of gave the idea of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine a whole new perspective, and a whole new, you know, it became very attractive. And that really when the Jewish immigration into Palestine took place on a much larger scale. 4 years later, or 3 years later, you know, on May 15, 1948, 41 years ago almost, next week, the British forces left Palestine, and the so-called War of Independence by the Israelis, the Arabs were defeated, and the majority of Palestine became occupied, and the new state of Israel was declared, and consequently the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians ended up as refugees. Now, there were a number of efforts, you know, to remedy the situation. Those who have become victimized by this whole situation, went about developing means and ways to remedy the situation, to right what is the wrongs that have been done unto them. Political efforts, efforts through the diplomatic means, through the United Nations, all kinds of efforts, you know, one of which is the right to return for the Palestinians, which is guaranteed by the United Nations. In 1949, a resolution that was passed by the UN, by the Security Council, by the General Assembly, sponsored by the U.S. at the time, spoke of the right of the Palestinians to return or their right to colonization. And ever since then, you know, every year this question comes up since 1949 and almost passes unanimously as to their rights to return to their homeland. Unfortunately, you know, history cannot be for the convenience of what is right. You know, history is sometimes a tool in the hands of the powerful, in the hands of the manipulator. And that, in essence, is what happened. Many wars have taken place since 1948 until recently. You know, what's going on is really a form of war. In 1967, the rest of Palestine was lost to the Israelis. And everybody seems to think that that's when the problem really started. They think of Israel as having been there all that time, and that the Palestinians are only those people who live in the West Bank and Gaza. Those who have been under a military occupation for the past 21 years, or now 22 years, since June 1967. The Palestinians, as I said, organized in terms of political means and in terms of military means as well. And that's when the Palestine Liberation Organization came into being. Now, I know the image of the PLO is somewhat different for the majority of people in this country, because what they have seen or what they have been exposed to, be it in the media or by whatever other means, has almost set a certain stereotype. You know. But in reality, the PLO is a government in exile. It did everything that governments normally do. You know, it is schools and hospitals and scholarships. It's a movie industry. It's as well as an armed resistance. You know, it's not only what you see, an image of a keffiyeh and a Kalashnikov rifle or something like this, or what you hear about hijackings and so on. The PLO probably has done very little of that compared to other groups and other organizations. But that's what it's all about. It came into being to address the Palestinian issue. Because when you have a major refugee problem, you have a major human problem. People need all kinds of things besides settlement and besides the fact that they have to go on, they have to live, they need someone to look after them, to organize them, to educate them, to provide them with medical cares and with education and with the means of life, everyday life, much as we do in the rest of the world. The PLO is not immune to problems. It has not been immune to problems. It has not been immune to differing political thoughts. You know, I am one who is in disagreement of what's going on today, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. But in all fairness, it's, you know, much like any power. In fact, it is in a lot of ways modeled really after Western models in a lot of ways. It enjoys a limit of democracy, you know, under the prevailing conditions and so on. People are elected rather than selected. It's made of all kinds of political groups, you know, with different political thinkings, you know, from the far right to the far left, indulges in a very, very lively debate, you know, most of the time. Some are a bit more radical than others. Some want to, you know, to carry on with the armed struggle and because it is the only solution, and some see that this is no solution, that the political struggle is one that can really benefit the people of Palestine, and so on. And it has become in a lot of ways, the embodiment of the Palestinians, their self-expression. It has become to really enjoy an incredible popularity. Now, I may or may not like that as an individual, but the fact of the matter that the current leadership of the PLO enjoys almost an overwhelming support. It's amazing. You can run all kinds of surveys among all kinds of Palestinians, and you will find total support to the PLO. And that's why the Israelis have been having a lot of problems with the population in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the problem, to me, is very simple. There is a military occupation. To solve the problem, you have to be rid of the military occupation. The military occupation took place in 6 days or less. You know, why couldn't take place? Why the undoing of that couldn't take place in 6 days or less? The people in the occupied West Bank have no political rights, have no civil rights, have no human rights, you know, have no right to a job, for instance, you know, a decent job, can't go for, you know, let's say a distance from campus to the fraternity houses, you know, without having to go through 2 or 3 checkpoints and so on. People are humiliated constantly. And they have, for the past 20 years, relied on so many different means to remedy the situation, to alleviate their suffering and so on, to it has been all along, you know, all these means have been a non-starter. They got fed up, you know, they took to the streets, young children, you know, little boys and girls took to the streets because they are tired of being humiliated. They are tired of seeing their parents being humiliated. They're tired of that kind of oppression that goes on day and night. They're tired of the raids that come at any moment. They're tired of the collective punishment. If a 5-year-old child throws a stone, then his home gets demolished. Now that's really unprecedented. And the thing is about people power, it's really incredible. It's self-generating. You know, it builds its own momentum and it goes on. Yeah. There seems to be an endless source of energy when people really take things into their own hands. For 17 months, the Palestinians have been struggling with their bare hands. They don't have guns. They face the tanks with stones. Now, Mr. Shamir calls this violence, you know, that the people are really violent. And that's why he sends the soldiers, you know, armed to the teeth, you know, shooting at random, destroying at random, because these people are violent. Yeah. And it really is quite sickening when you see a 3-year-old girl shot in the head, huh? Because she's violent. You know? Or a 10-year-old, because he threw a stone at a tank. Now, Mr. Shamir, the current Prime Minister of Israel, and Mr. Rabin, the current Defense Minister, you know, his famous statement last February 1988, when he says that we are going to deal with them with might, force, and beatings. We're going to beat them to death. I'm sure many of you have seen on television a group of soldiers grab a young boy or a young girl and just beat them, literally beat them to death. Huh? The Israelis acknowledge that in the last 16 months, 470 people were killed. Well, our figures are a lot more than that. Those who have been imprisoned are really in the thousands. The detention camps that are... you know, have been really condemned by all the major world organizations. The conditions, the fact that you get arrested for whatever reason, for no reason actually. You are not charged. You can be put in prison for 6 months, renewable. You know, you can. They can come and grab you, put you in prison for 6 months, and for another 6 months, and for another 6 months, and for another 6 months. And it can go on forever. This is what's going on today. But what is really the source of this? I'm going to talk about something that others may not have talked about, or may, which is really the source of the conflict. What is the source of the conflict? Or how is it seen by those who have the means to direct the source of the conflict based upon their own resources and energies and historical background and perceptions? The Jews came into Palestine with the notion that Palestine was a land without people, and that the Jews were a people without land. And obviously you bring the people without the land to the land without a people, and you have a very nice marriage. Well, this was not the case at all. In fact, Palestine was a very viable place. If you go back into the writings of scholars, you know, Orientalists, those who have gone on trip into the region and so on, in the last century or the century before or before or so on, or if you view, let's say, the history of harbors, you know, in Palestine, Haifa and Akka and other places and so on, you'll find that there was a very active trade going on. People really tilled that land for a number of centuries, you know, an overwhelming majority of peasants, people who have depended on agriculture. So people were there. Now, this slogan is a very clever slogan. For one, you know, it ignites a lot of emotional feelings among the Jews. It's enticing because they really had to entice them to come. You know, a Jewish American is an American. You know, his roots are here. So you have to really entice him to come to Palestine. And the same thing goes for the German and the Canadian and the British and the French and the Yemeni and the Moroccan and all these things. You have to really give them something. You have to entice them. You work with fear and reward and punishment. You generate this, hysteria about the discriminations, about the killings and so on, which, you know, you have legitimate examples, you have tangible things to show, to prove that these things can occur. So the slogan, you know, is an attractive one. It's a very clever one. But I see it differently. And I'm not just the common observer. I'm a person who's really involved with this process. Yeah. Now, this slogan was also established to build a policy. In essence, what it says, the Zionist perception of Palestine says that there can never really be coexistence between us and the Arabs of Palestine. They have viewed the people of Palestine as their antithesis. They looked at it as a struggle between two nationalism, and the existence of one will necessarily depend on the obliteration of the other. One is the antithesis of the other. And, you know, look at all their writings, beginning with Theodore Herzl, going through Jabotinsky, onto Ben-Gurion, to Golda Meir, or her famous statements that there is no such thing as the Palestinians, as recently as 1969, to Begin's description of them as two-legged animals, to Shamir's most recent description of them as grasshoppers, and so on. The list is endless. Now, I'm not saying that. They're saying that. And the only means of existence for the Palestinians is really measured against their energy in terms of helping to build and sustain their occupiers. In other words, the Zionist state. And any admission to any limit, no matter how weak it is, of the Palestinian realizing their concept of nationhood is viewed by Mr. Shamir and others to be a major and a fundamental threat to their very own existence. That's how they see it. Because they continue to have this archaic perception that the struggle continues to be a struggle between two different nationalisms. That one can only exist at the expense of the other. That for one to survive, the other must be obliterated. And that's why they keep, you know, coming up with all these new different means. I mean, some things that can make you, you know, laugh and cry at the same time. They have this new marvel of technology, a new machine that has so many different things. And I throw stones, you know. It's just got to find the kids. You have all these machines that have, it's like a conveyor belt throwing stones at little children and so on. You know, when they get tired of that, they shoot, you know, rubber bullets, plastic bullets. You hear things that you, you know, people really have no perception of. Hmm? And, you know, what does this, all this have to do with us in America? What kind of policy the United States has had over the past so many years? You know, I, being in Washington, have for a while really believed or had the illusion that you can, you know, affect the situation. You know, go to Capitol Hill and armed with what you believe is right, you know. And you go and say, I am right. Right is on my side. You know, you ought to be convinced, Mr. Congressman or Mr. Senator. But things do not work that way. That's fairy tale. No, there is, you know, fundamental and real things that really do affect the situation, the real world, in other words, not only ideals. And I still, you know, today I disagree with a lot of my Arab colleagues who still believe that you can really lobby Congress and you can really lobby the Senate and you can really express, if you go to the sources of power, those who run America politically, then you can affect a change. No, I don't think change can come about this way. I don't think, for instance, if, you know, black Americans did not take into the streets in the 60s, they could have waited for another 50 years for legislation in Congress and so on. People have to take matters into their own hands. You know, if people did not demonstrate against the involvement in Vietnam, it could have probably gone on for a long time. You know, but because, again, you know, people were affected by it, it touched their daily living, the coffins were coming home, the destruction was, you know, visible, it has entered everybody's living room and so on, then, you know, they became effective. I think what we have to do is really seek grassroots support, you know, come and talk to people and so on. And you don't have to agree. You know, what I'm saying is, you know, let us provoke a debate on the subject. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody should agree with me, quite the contrary. You know, I have, for one, have a different point of view of, let's say, the leadership of the PLO. I think it is selling out too much, to be quite honest with you. But that's, you know, for the Palestinians to decide. I'm not in a position of power to affect that. That's my own personal point of view. But to view, you know, the kind of relationship that this country has had with Israel or, you know, has had really with the rest of the world. Because the policy towards Israel is not something on its own, you know. It's part of a global policy for the United States. And that's what they have to see. You know? Quite honestly, you know, people talk about the billions of dollars that American taxpayers put out to sustain the state of Israel. Now, I can talk to you about that, but I'd be lying to myself because I don't see the situation that way. Quite honestly, I don't think Israel, as far as the U.S. is concerned, is a very expensive investment. It is not. $7-8 billion a year. Well, NATO costs a great deal more than that. We have 300,000 soldiers in, you know, in Germany and other places that really cost as much, if not more. We have 50,000 soldiers in Japan that cost just as much. And probably Israel, when it comes to being effective, is just as effective as NATO, militarily that is, you know, definitely more effective than the 50,000 soldiers in Japan and other places. You know, Israel can destroy the reactor in Iraq, in Baghdad, can strike against Tunis. They have those long-range missiles that can be armed with nuclear weapons that do not enter any kind of agreement between the Soviet Union and the United States. Why are they there? So it's quite an asset. I think what the Arabs have failed to do is to make Israel a very expensive investment for the United States. Now, I know there is a vital interest for the U.S. in the region. vital interest in the region. Oil, commerce, industry, strategic, and so on. You know, we all know that when, you know, during the war between Iran and Iraq, the United States sent its navy into the Gulf because it has a vital interest in the region. Yeah. But what we have failed to do is to make Israel a more expensive investment, so the United States will have to change its policy. This is a hard world. It does not work on ideals. Yeah. It works on strategic perception. It works on the global theory. And look at the world. The world is today is not as it used to be, you know, 100 years ago. Yeah. It's getting a much, much smaller place. You know, there's a whole new world order going on today. You know, Europe is getting together by 1992. You know, the Cold War is almost over, except for a few lunatics in this country that want to keep it going on. You know, seriously. You know, all kinds of agreements and so on. You know, INF treaty, and the future other treaties and so on. You know, and a new openness in the Soviet Union. You know, a new openness in Eastern Europe. All new different world order. And I think the Palestinians fit into that world order. You know, there are again, you know, a few crazies. One of them is Yitzhak Shamir, who thinks, no, you know, I'm going to continue to have ties and so on. You know, it's just really is just outside the mainstream of events. I think there is a change again taking shape in this country, not only because people have been able to see, that's very important that people have been able to see things on television, exposed to it, you know, develop a bit better knowledge, really, of what's going on. Because you need some knowledge to build any kind of analysis, any kind of opinion, you know, to build an educated opinion, to overcome the prejudice, you know, your first judgment. We tend to judge things very quickly. When we become to know a little bit more about them, we view them differently. There's also change in the political sense, you know. I mean, quite honestly, Shamir comes here and on his first and his last visit, and he was a pain in the butt for the U.S. Administration. And so things are taking, beginning to change very slowly, very rapidly. The U.S. official view of the Palestinian is beginning to change. The U.S. is really beginning to develop a more coherent policy because it had a position in the region, and not what I would call a policy. You know, a position that okay, if, you know, I'll have this and this. How, you know, I have my assets, I have my interests, and my liabilities. And I will take a position depending upon what. Now, they are beginning to think in longer terms, in strategic terms, you know, the future of the region. I know I have talked about too many different issues, and one can really go on because it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy topic. It's a complicated topic. There are so many different things, so many different passions involved with the Middle East conflict. And we're not expected to really know all the details of it. Yeah. But I think it would be good for us as human beings to learn about things, to learn about the Middle East, to develop our own opinions on knowledge, on factual things, that rather than, you know, just the common sort of gut feelings, I like it, I don't like it, you know, black and white kind of situation. I know a person like me, for instance, who really gave a number of speeches. And in the past, I used to prepare my speeches very well. You know, come and, you know, just read it and so on. We had to overcome so many different things. It's not easy to come and talk to an audience like you because we don't fit the mainstream. First of all, you have to overcome, you know, how funny my name sounds. You know, that's a different name. You have to work so hard to build credibility because you have certain stereotypes in your end. And that's why I guess I decided to come and talk to you casually, really, today. I think we have embarked on a new, different course. It's a challenging course. And I believe when we perceive our challenges, you know, with the intent of seeing them through, then we can really achieve a great deal. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Today, University Forum has presented Saeed Arikat, Executive Director of the Palestine Congress of North America. His topic was Palestine, an update. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.